Welcome to Chromatic Elephant, a podcast about race, trauma, and the impact of white body supremacy. Here are your hosts, Tyler Reitzner and Resma Menakem.
Hi, this is Tyler Reitzner.
This is Resma Menakem.
And this is the Chromatic Elephant. We're here to talk about some subjects that'll bring the elephant right in the room.
when we started talking about this a while ago, one of the things that we wanted to do was tackle things that that we know are already exist and kind of make things visible that are invisible, right? Mm-hmm. Especially as it relates between white bodies and black bodies.
Yeah.
Right. And even though white bodies and black bodies are not the only bodies on this earth, I'm a black man, so I can only speak from my perspective. And so that's what I'll be speaking from.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully as people begin to listen to us and vibe with us, they'll be able to utilize some of the things that we're talking about in their own lives. Not take it whole cloth, but be able to utilize some of the things.
Yeah, for me, what really started this journey into wanting to do this podcast was that, you know, when we would talk, mm-hmm. even from the first time, there was a certain connection in the way we talked,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That I really, I enjoyed it because it was intellectually stimulating, but B, it was also challenging, like,
mm-hmm.
and in a way that I could handle it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think part of that was part of that was both of our professions lie in working with trauma in some way, shape, or form, and having that framework to work through. And I think in doing that, it also gave me at least some ways of talking about race and how it affects me in ways I didn't even realize it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and how that is affecting the way I relate to people in the world too,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and people you love. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, you got African American kids, you got African American. What I mean, that's going to, you know, people think that when we engage and we love somebody, that in some way wipes away racism or white body supremacy. That's not the case. And so one of the things we want to do with Chromatic Elephant is just talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, because that's, until my wife is African American and I thought about race less than she did. And when we first got together and when we first started dating and even when we were getting married, and the longer and the deeper our connection stayed,
mm-hmm.
that's when I really noticed my own racism, mm-hmm. my own implicit bias,
mm-hmm.
And how that affected even my relationship, as you pointed out, with someone I love,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
feel literally the deepest connection I've ever felt with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Next to my children.
Right.
And because of that connection is what really brought out, like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason I've never had to worry about it, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't have to think
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the white guy.
Right.
I get
right.
to do whatever. You know, it's kind of right. and I didn't know how much I get to do whatever I want without I don't have to worry about race every day.
Right.
And that's
right.
one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this, is because I think white people are, in general, even the most liberal, socialist, and
conscious,
as we've talked,
woke,
all that. Well, and as we talked about, sometimes those are the most dangerous, and I've been that guy, I've been terrified of being that guy,
right,
you know,
right.
which makes me even more that guy,
right.
in a lot of ways.
Right.
So it's like, if we don't start talking about this
right.
stuff and dealing with it, instead of just trying to...
Right.
Be nice.
Right.
And
right.
be like,
right.
oh, no, I'm not racist.
Right.
I don't have any.
Right.
No, we're
good. Right.
And a lot of it, again, for me, goes back to dealing with my own trauma, in that I know, like, I had to address the things that were done to me and the things that I've lived with from my own child abuse trauma and the PTSD and all of those things.
Right.
And what I'm finding very interesting is the parallel process of how racism affects me to that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started to not find excuses but explanations, and try and break down the good and the evil and get out of that, because it made things too isolated to really heal. And I think... and this is nothing but a theory on my end, is that if we can start talking about it and opening up conversations, bringing that elephant in the room and just looking it square in the eye and dealing with the discomfort.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be comfortable.
So I think we done already kind of shifted into this. So let me say this. So, I think for a long time, one of the prevailing white liberal strategies has been, let's just talk about it. Let's all get in the room. Let's talk about race. Let's do. And then what ends up happening is that because white people have not developed a culture around the abolition of white body supremacy, they have not developed a culture around how to language this. They haven't developed a culture around what actually happens in the body. They haven't developed a culture around nuance. They haven't developed a culture around body. None of it. Mm-hmm. So when we start to begin to talk about race, white people go into these protective responses, right?
Yeah.
And they happen so fast that you can't catch it. And so part of what I've been saying for at least the past 5-6 years is that white people are going to have to figure out some way to slow this down so they can develop cultures. First of all, stop hurting and stop rewounding people of color. That's the first thing. The second thing is that they have to start developing a culture that can actually hold the discussion and the transformation that needs to occur. There is no culture.
Yeah.
There is a segregationist culture that was built. There is an assimilation culture that was built. But the idea of developing a culture based on the abolition of white body supremacy, based on anti-racism, there is no culture. There's strategy, not culture.
And again, I go back, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the things, like, as a liberal white guy, quote unquote, or a liberal white guy in recovery, you're trying to be, whatever you want to get. And I don't know. I'm starting to just realize, just own it, and because that's the whole point. And again, it goes back to that parallel process of healing with trauma.
Right.
Like, I have to own my story.
Right.
In order to heal from it and grow. And I think with white folks, one of the things they're not owning it. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm running into personally is I realizing that a lot of that was an adaptive reaction. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes back to your book, My Grandmother's Hands. Like, there are thousands of years of white bodies beating up on white bodies. And instead of, like, addressing that, so like you say, you can talk about it, but there has to be something behind the talk.
Right.
And it's not, you know, one of the things you pointed out to me in one of our early conversations that released is the idea of trauma is kind of this two-headed monster where it's not just about what happened to you.
Right.
It's then what didn't you get?
Exactly right.
And for white folks, when you talk about this adaption into racism and slavery, a lot of it was this reaction of like, okay, and believe it or not, and I've been looking up some studies around this because I'm fascinated by this. The neurobiology behind it is, at least it's not me. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, you have, because it's, you always ask yourself, why didn't white folks that don't believe in slavery stand up for, you know, this? Why didn't they do something more? Mm-hmm. Because it literally, there was an adaptive part of them going, at least it's not me.
You're right. Right.
At least it's not me. Right. And there's a weird false safety around that.
Right.
And we know from trauma work, if we don't address that stuff, those adaptations, if left unchecked, will get, they lead to really unhealthy behavior.
Well, one of the things that happens is that over time, it looks like personality. Those adaptive behaviors look like personality in the person, look like family traits in the family, and look like culture in the people.
Culture, that's, absolutely.
Because time decontextualizes trauma.
Yes.
The march of time decontextualizes. And people begin to internalize it. Because if my son, if I'm traumatized before I have children, and then I have children, but I've never dealt with the trauma, my children experience me as that's daddy. Now compound that by 500 years, 400 years in terms of native people, 500 years in terms of native people, indigenous people, 400 years in terms, I mean, just compound that and then build a whole structure on that.
Yeah.
Right? And
call it a culture.
And call it a culture. And here's the thing about the white body is that after the Middle Ages, so for 1,000 years, right after the fall of the Roman Empire, 500 AD to about 1500 AD, that was 1,000 years of elite white bodies kicking the hell out of peasants and poor white bodies.
Yeah.
I mean, insurrections, I mean, burnings, and the brutality on white women and the whole paternalistic thing, all of that stuff happened during the Dark and Middle Ages to white bodies. Then that body in 1492 came here. Right?
Yep.
And did what most traumatized bodies do. Traumatized bodies. Traumatized bodies.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's just, I mean, and so what I, the reason why I even signed on to do this with you, because, there are a lot of opportunities that I have to do stuff like this. But one of the reasons why I wanted to do this with you is that I think we come from two different worlds. We come from two different perspectives.
Yeah.
But we're both kind of walking in this world that's dealing with or trying to deal with race. And I think what we want to do is kind of what intrigued me about it is the opportunity to sit down, have people listen to a honest discussion. We ain't going to always agree on stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But at least we can talk about it, maybe have some people, other people who watch and listen to this, maybe have them begin to figure out how they co-create culture, and then hopefully in 9 generations we become a better place.
Yeah, that's tough. I always want to solve the problem, right? I don't want to, but I don't look at this podcast as something where we're going to go out and solve racism and
not even close.
Not even close. I'm even having a hard time saying that because I want to.
Yeah.
You know, I have, and part of that is my own crap that I'm bringing into it, and I don't even fully understand how that all works. Maybe we'll unpack that at some point. Mm-hmm. But it's also like just literally building a base understanding of what we're really dealing with and being honest about it, and also trying to do that in a way that honors the triggers that are going to happen, because there are. I mean, there's no way we can talk to each other about this. There's no way we can talk to other people about this without having our own stuff coming up.
Right.
And I'm intrigued to see how we can go there, and if there's some ways we can, not only have that happen, but then address it, become aware, and see how we can work through that. And especially with your expertise around how that works in the body.
Right.
And that's been revolutionary for me personally in understanding why I jump to certain conclusions and certain things. And it's really interesting to find out, if you pay attention to your body, it's already reacting before it gets to your brain.
Before
your brain
is just trying to adapt. The brain is like trying to walk through mud when it comes to this type of stuff, right? By the time it gets to the brain and consciousness, it's done.
Yeah.
It's a wrap. It's because this stuff becomes so decontextualized and gets so tied into the primal parts of us that it almost becomes reflexive. It's like like taking a rubber mallet and hitting my knee and watching it. It takes a culture to slow that down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just individual. What happened to me and my people in terms of enslavement didn't just happen to me personally, individually.
Yeah.
It happened to my people. So many of the ways that we try and deal with this is individual. Well, let's just me and you talk about it, or let's just, you know, get together, talk about it in more or less an individual way. But the trauma that happens and continues to happen to my body doesn't just happen to me. It happens to my people.
Yeah.
And it happened to my people. But we have not developed, even thought about, how do we begin to develop something that can address what happened to a people, not just what happened to us individually. And we haven't begun to even think about that.
Well, and I think you brought up one of the key points earlier when you were talking about lack of nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a very, we're talking about such a nuanced thing. And I know when you're talking about reaction, like my reaction, even when we're talking, a lot of times I'm having to fight my own reaction of like, let's simplify this.
Right.
Because it's not simple.
Right.
And because what we're talking about is a multifaceted, like there's your experience, my experience, there are community experiences in different parts.
That's
it's
right.
not even just about what the African American experience is or the white. There are different experiences in different communities within different states, different regions.
Right.
So this is not a one size fits all type of deal.
No.
And conversation, again, to me, and I think it goes back to this idea of realizing that it's not just about what happened, which white folks like to, I'll focus on that because it's kind of easy to focus on that. Oh my God, of course, what happened was awful.
Right.
Well, what didn't you get?
That's right.
And then how do we replace that?
That's
from a trauma perspective, we know that's how people heal.
Right.
Well, and
the first thing that has to happen in terms of people healing is that the trauma has to stop. That's the first thing, right?
Yeah.
Right. And when we talk about what has happened to indigenous people in this country, the trauma hasn't stopped.
No.
And I think we have to acknowledge that when it comes to African American people in this country and people of African descent, the trauma hasn't stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a different process that has to be developed within my own cultural communities to deal with the ravages of white body supremacy. So in my community, in the African American community, is not just being put upon in terms of living in a society that is founded on the white body being the supreme standard of humanity and everything else is a deviant from that standard. It's also the fact that I also live in this society and I'm continuously being inundated with messages that I'm not really a human being.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is that after about 400 years of that kind of encoding, African American people also take that in and internalize it. It's what I call decontextualized, internalized white body supremacy, right? And measuring ourselves against the white body standard. And then doing things to each other or doing things to other people of color or doing things to my LGBTQ community brothers and sisters or doing things, you know, or other marginalized people within my own cultural group. And those internalized pieces, that's our work to do. That's what we have to do. But what I think happens sometimes is that the work that I have to do, white people think that that's also the work that they should be doing within our communities, right?
Yeah.
Rather than doing what they need to do in their communities.
Well, again, it's, and I believe based on my own experience, like, I get into that mode when I'm trying, when I don't want to do something. Like, when I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like, I'd way rather focus on you than focus on me.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So I'm going to help you.
That's right.
Or even better yet, like, I've made the mistake, as we pointed out, of asking for your help to help you. Right. Help me help you.
That's right.
I would rather do that than look at myself and go, why don't I have a culture?
Which
is really one of the underlying things that I think, because everything you just said, I can guarantee you any white person listening to is going to be like, whoa. Like, it's going to be so hard to take it. Even some of it was, you know, I'm having like, okay, you know, even though I know you're absolutely right. Like, to talk about, because at the end of the day, addressing the fact that I really don't have a culture. And I know that there are white folks, again, abuse isn't a culture.
Right, right.
Adaptations aren't culture. Right. And we've been, especially since coming to this country specifically, but it goes back even further, but we don't really have a culture. And this whole melting pot idea is not a culture either. Again, that's just an adaptation. So we have to start recognizing, like, we have a problem here.
Right.
And stop beating up on other people because we can't address our own problem.
Exactly. That's the only way I think we're going to begin to. And like I always say in my workshops and when I'm talking, I always say that this stuff, all we're doing right now is beginning. All we can begin to do right now is start the process and begin to seed and make sure that the ground is fertile enough so the seeds can come up. But this, for me, honestly, this is like 9 generations. Before my kids is my hope that they will be able to get to a place to where some of this stuff is not wreaking havoc on their nervous system, is not wreaking havoc on their heart, on their muscular skeletal system, on their sexual organs, on all of that. That's my hope, right? But I don't think about this as me doing and making a dent in this right now. I have the only reason why me and you can be sitting up here talking is because there were people who resisted, right? Yeah. There were people who resisted. And my contribution to this is to be the next generation, part of the next generation that also resists this standard and these protocols that are based on the white body. That's it.
And I think that's probably the best we can do at this point.
Yeah.
And it, God, there's so many things as you were talking about the resistance, mainly because I just look at how much pain white folks are in that they don't even realize. And that they literally medicate this lack of cultural connectedness. By hurting other people.
Yeah.
And because their answer, or our answer, I should say, because I'm included in this, the answer that's quick and easy is, well, okay, then, like, equality is my favorite. Because it's like, oh, okay, well, if you want equality, you have now access to our culture. Or what we've put together as a culture.
Right.
This culture that has abused you in horrific ways.
And continues to.
Which in and of itself is abusive, quite frankly, and do nothing to support, in fact, usually mock or class your culture. You know what I mean? As if, no, it goes back to the white body and culture is the supreme standard.
That's right.
So people who are listening, especially white folks, who are like, what do you mean we don't have a culture? We have culture. It's like, if you did, you wouldn't have to. You would be able to comfortably be around other cultures, knowing you're anchored in your own.
Well, without having to once you interface with these cultures, without having to result to land theft.
land theft.
Or genocide.
Genocide.
Or enslavement or imperialism or colonial. I mean, you know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
I mean, you know, this is, I don't know if you want to go here, but let's go here.
Yeah.
There's something that, as you were talking, it reminded me of something. So, do you play basketball basketball, or are you into mm-hmm. sports and stuff
Very,
like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So about 2 days ago, a basketball player by the name of Russell Westbrook
mm-hmm.
plays for Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yep.
Standing by his bench, right? And this white dude and his wife says, you should get on your knees like you used to do, right? So Russell Westbrook says, goes, you know,
yeah.
you know, basically says, you know who you talking to and da 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 da, and you can heckle me, but that was beyond, and I'll F you up and I'll fuck you up and mm-hmm. I'll, you know, fuck your wife up too because she repeated it. The reason why I'm bringing this up is not so much what happened, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was mad. I mean, he was like, I'm on my family, on my life, I'm gonna mess you up, right? Mm-hmm. The interesting thing was, and this is what I mean about how the society is founded on this idea that the white body should be just and this guy happened to be a guy that's been known for saying racist stuff and all this different type of stuff, right? Because once that happened,
which shouldn't matter,
yeah. But mm-hmm. once it happened, all of the social media found out who the guy was, and then all this stuff started coming up, right? Mm-hmm. So they got it all in film. So what happened was, is when I'm watching this on TV, the first thing that people say is Russell Westbrook he shouldn't have said the things that he said. Yes, the guy was wrong, but Russell Westbrook should have shown more restraint. And when they interviewed Russell was like, if I had it all over to do again, I'd say the same damn thing. And I will tell you, as a black man that saw that, I was like, you're damn right. Because there is this thing in this society that is the black person, the black body, no matter how wounded it gets, the things that man said to Russell Westbrook
mm-hmm.
is a thing that, in terms of trauma, is a rewounding.
Yeah.
It is not just, I'm heckling you. No. There is in context. Right?
Yeah.
And so when you say something like that, what's happening is that this society is built on wounding and rewounding African-American people, and African-American people always giving deference to the white body. Right?
Yeah.
Even if the white body is dead ass wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Give deference to it. So when Russell said, I would do the exact same thing, there was a part of me in my belly that was like, absolutely. And my wife was sitting there too, and me and her looked at each other, and she said, did it turn off?
Yeah, that's
all right. And she said, you know what? I'm glad he said that. And I said, I am too. And then I said, you know, I'm tired as a black man. I am tired of every time somebody wounds me,
mm-hmm.
I have to take the high road. Right? I'm tired of it. Right?
Yeah.
And my wife said this, and I laughed, but I know what she meant. She goes, you know what? I'm just going to be honest with you. She goes, I'm living on the low road. She goes, I'm living for a little while. I'm living on, because I am not going to continue to be wounded and then act like I'm the one that's supposed to be magnanimous about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason why I'm bringing this up is that in a cultural context, there are certain things that the white body is used to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even when the white body says, even when people are on my side, right, there's this sense that, and you need to give deference. And whenever I see a black body or an indigenous body or aboriginal body stand up and say, nah, I'm not doing that. You have wounded me. Mm-hmm. And continue to re-wound me, and I'm not going to make it all right in order for us to get along. We don't get along no way. That is not part of the structure. So for me to now give up part of my, not only get wounded by you,
yeah,
but then also offer up part of myself to you so we can now move it along. And for Russell Westbrook to say, "Nah, it stops here."
Yeah,
I just loved it.
And it, I laugh out of discomfort because mm-hmm. I know everything you're saying is dead on, mm-hmm. and I've caught myself doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, there's that part of me, like, let's just, and it's always because of how uncomfortable I
yeah.
am.
Yeah.
So at the and so well, you know. I've addressed, again, it goes back to,
yeah.
we'll address the thing that happened, that's but right. we aren't going to address
that's
what
right.
didn't happen or what
that's right.
the wounding really that, is
that's
about.
Right. That's exactly right.
So I've addressed it.
That's right.
You know,
I said I'm sorry.
I've apologized. I'm sorry.
Right.
He said he's sorry.
Right.
Or, oh, he's just doing that. You
that's
don't.
Right.
He just said that from, he's being a
that's
jerk.
That's right.
Blah, blah, blah.
That's
and it's
right.
like,
that's
that,
right. That's right.
You, and that's where that whole, the whole, like the idea of colorblindness is obviously a white idea. Because like, because it only benefits us to
right.
be colorblind.
That's exactly.
Like, let's oh, we're colorblind. We don't see
color.
So like
yeah.
oh, we're
yeah.
we're not racist,
but,
and that's fine.
But right
when that happens,
that's
if
right.
you aren't paying attention
that's
to
right.
the fact that that's an African American man
that's right.
who's got all who's got the historical and generational trauma, which
yeah.
goes back to,
yeah.
I think it's important to acknowledge the historical trauma
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot
mm-hmm.
going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Which we'll dig into in other
mm-hmm.
episodes, but the generational trauma is that ongoing.
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 Mm-hmm.
And there are two different things,
mm-hmm.
and you can see that. And when you put that into context, it's like, yeah, okay,
mm-hmm.
Russell Westbrook, his
mm-hmm.
reaction made complete sense.
Complete sense. In,
and I would have done it.
That's right. In context.
Anyone would have done it.
In context. That anyone who believes that the person that's doing it is actually a human being. So
yeah.
so a lot of times, even the people that are listening to us, so many people are going to be recoiling, right? They're
yeah.
going to be like, well, you know, especially some of the white folks and,
yeah.
some of the people of color. But the fact is that if you understand this in context, and that is what Russell Westbrook was talking about, in context, how dare you? How dare you say that to me? You can't tell me that you are not actively trying to wound me.
It's literally a threat.
Literally.
Literally a threat.
Literally. Because the context of
yes.
that is built on death, enslavement, rape, this person that's sitting in front of you or standing in front of you is not really of your same species. That's
mm-hmm.
what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And even if Russell can't articulate it, something happens.
Exactly.
And he understands it.
Yep.
He don't have to be able to say, well, in this year, in that year, in this year, he understands what that means. And he understands that the person who is saying it understands it.
Yeah.
There is an agreement that what you're saying, you are really saying. And the thing is that what white people do is that they do this thing like, well, I'm not sure he really meant that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I've done it myself. And it's always about making me comfortable.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
oh my God.
Yeah.
Because if it's not.
Right.
Then I gotta like,
yeah.
then, oh crap.
Well, you gotta
then
look
I gotta
it.
Look at it.
You gotta look at it. You gotta look at it. And that's the only way. This is one of the things I talk about, the racial suffering's edge. White people never have to go to the racial suffering's edge. White people may be poor.
Mm-hmm.
White people may be gay and lesbian. All the things that impact you, right?
Yep.
but not race. You don't have to go to the, and that particular thing, race, impacts all of those other things. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I say. So my last workshop, I was in the workshop, and I had a poor white dude said, he goes, Reshma, I agree. I know what I'm saying. I need some help with this. I know the next thing I get in, and I knew it was going to be a doozy, mm-hmm. right? He said, I'm sitting up here and I'm listening to what you're saying. And I'm saying, yeah, but I was poor. Mm-hmm. I was raised poor. I was a poor, I lived in the country. I was a poor, we were a poor white family.
Yeah,
very, very, very poor. And he said, and so I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm the same as you. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I listened to him and I said, well, let me ask you something. I said, don't compare yourself to me. Right. Because there are living in the city and living in rural and stuff. There are these differences and all that different stuff. So I said, don't compare yourself to me. I said, but let me ask you this. I said, let's say we took all, let's say we had a big corn silo, mm-hmm. right? A glass corn silo. And what we were able to do was take all of the poor bodies in America and put them in the corn silo. Are the black bodies at the top of that silo or at the bottom of that silo?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he goes, and I said, hold it. And he goes, okay. I said, that's what I want you to understand, is that even though you are poor, the other poor people, right,
yeah.
have to contend with race.
I can speak from having a poor, quote-unquote, white trash background mm-hmm. As part of my story growing up, a big part of it. And then kind of living in two extremes, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you,
mm-hmm.
going from that, yes, people treat you different, and yes, it is an abusive situation, mm-hmm. but all I literally had to do
mm-hmm.
was move from one parent to the other,
wow.
and economic situation changed, and the way people treated me was totally different.
Mm-hmm.
That does... My African-American wife, I'm not going to... get too much into her own
absolutely,
story.
Absolutely.
She's a Harvard MBA, smart lady, comes from a great family of
right.
all very
right.
accomplished folks uh-huh. who, like, I'm the low guy on the totem pole during right. Thanksgiving dinner
right.
who didn't go to grad school
right.
or go
right.
to, like, Stanford
right.
or Harvard,
right.
you know.
Right.
And I still see on
yeah.
a daily basis what she's got to deal with.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's different.
It's different.
It's different. And it's
not,
all because it's literally, I'm sorry, but it's literally just because of the color of her skin.
Right, right.
That
right,
is
right.
it. People don't know her. They don't know they just see that and boom, they treat her different.
Mm. And it's not just different. It's different and brutal.
Yeah. It's even the little stuff
mm-hmm.
that, and I say that with quotes,
mm-hmm.
you can't see it on the
mm-hmm.
podcast, but that I say that with quotes because I've watched that stuff and studied it
mm-hmm.
from a neuroscience point of view enough to know that that stuff is actually so insidious
mm-hmm.
because it seems like a little thing, but it keeps piling
That's
up
right.
and they weigh and they are exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I watch
yeah.
What she goes through. I also watch, we have a biracial son who goes through.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know he's going
yeah.
through it yet.
Yeah.
I didn't know, and we I know we're running up against time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how important it was to white people to know the race of another person
yes.
until
yes.
I had this child.
Yes.
Because it on a weekly basis,
mm-hmm.
and it's always, he loves going grocery shopping
mm-hmm.
with me. In fact, Costco, for
mm-hmm.
some reason,
yeah.
is like going to Disneyland.
Well, it is.
Yeah, like, oh, I love that. Let's go, Daddy, I want to go with
yeah.
you. You know, he's 3 years old, he thinks it's great.
Right.
Yeah, mainly because he gets free food.
That's right.
Even though half the free food, like, if I bought it, he wouldn't eat it at
That's
home.
Right.
But
That's
it's
right.
at Costco. So
right.
anyway, I digress. We go every week, pretty much every weekend, at some point, we go to Costco and do some shopping and buy some stuff. And without fail, at
yeah.
least once,
yeah.
usually 2 to 3 times,
yeah.
some usually older white woman, but white folks will come up to us and wonder about his race because they'll see him with me. He's got brown eyes, curly hair. I'm, you know, bald yet when I do have hair, it's a little blonde, you know, German back. So I'm like as white as you get with a kid that most of them think is Latino.
Right.
Because he's tan and a little darker, curly hair, long curly hair. And it's like, oh my God. And people, and they get, and there's times where I get, I can't take it.
That's right.
Because it makes me so angry.
Right.
And I will say something to them and they look at me like I'm a monster. Mm-hmm. Like we're just asking you.
Right.
But they have no idea
right.
how this, and it really it's a constant reinforcement to me of things I don't realize my son is going to have to grow up with.
Right.
This constant reminder that he's different.
Right. He's deviant from the standard.
That's it. Yeah.
He's a deviant from the standard of humanness. And I'm not saying that that is just. I'm saying that this whole system is structured on that. And yeah, man, it's deep.
And people, you know, to end on, they will say, they think that by telling me how cute he is, that makes up for it. Oh, he's so cute. But it's the way that they kind of talk about him.
That's right.
They're talking about him like he's at a petting zoo.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
It's like he's cute because he's not a human. He's just a,
exactly.
You know,
he's another species.
He's another species.
That's
what a cute little puppy dog.
That's
it's
exactly
like,
right.
Yeah, that's my son.
That's my son.
And, and so I get at some level. Again, I'm not Russell Westbrook. I don't have those.
Right.
I'm starting to understand. I get where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Like why he would act that. I would. I do.
Yes.
I at the grocery
that's
store.
Right. That's
I'm
exactly.
getting angry about why is race so important to you?
Yeah.
Oh. I've never had to deal with it.
That's exactly
and my wife will remind me of that too. She's like, you're new to the racism stuff. Just hang in there.
Just hang in there. We'll work it out.
And so that's the... on that note, we will continue to work it out. And I am new to this racism stuff because I'm a white guy. And we will... and that's not an excuse. That's just an explanation.
That's what it is.
So thanks for joining us on Chromatic Elephant, and we will see you next time.
Deuces.
Thank you for joining us on Chromatic Elephant. Support for this podcast comes from My Grandmother's Hands and Resma Menekin at resma.com or text RESMAA to 55222. Support also comes from Thriver Institute, helping organizations in social services, education, and pediatrics find practical and culturally responsive approaches to applying trauma-informed practices. Live to thrive. Chromatic Elephant is produced and directed by Tyler Reitzner and Resma Menekim, with technical production by Noah Brown and Andre Gobert. Thank you for listening, and keep acknowledging the Chromatic Elephant in the room.